Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for November 17, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two interviews scheduled for tonight. First, in a little bit, we'll hear from Bethany Morton, who is a historian, a graduate student at Yale, author of a chapter in a new collection from the New Press all about Walmart. And she has been researching Walmart's emergence from its roots in the Ozarks and how that culture contributed to its eventual growth and massive success. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview with Bruce Lawrence, who has put together a collection of Osama bin Laden's writings and statements published by Verso. We'll talk to him about what Osama is all about and what it feels like to be in such intimate intellectual contact with the heavily demonized terror of Tora Bora. So, before we get to all that, a couple of the economic headlines quickly, because time is short in the first part of this program. First, the weekly tally of jobless claims, that is the number of people who've lost their jobs and head over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits, fell by 25,000 last week to a 303,000, which is actually quite a pretty low number, back to where we were before the disruptions of the hurricanes in August and September. So this is indicating a somewhat stronger labor market than we've seen, perhaps a little pickup in the job market coming ahead. But the job market unemployment rate pretty low, and the Federal Reserve and Wall Street getting a little nervous about that. So they're pushing up interest rates. So it may not get all that much lower from here. The Federal Reserve reporting industrial production for the month of October up by 0.9%, regaining most of the ground lost in the aftermath of the hurricanes. Capacity utilization, that is the percentage of manufacturing capacity that's used, just under 80%, and 80% is considered something of a threshold when the Fed starts worrying about the economy getting too overheated and danger of inflation rising. American consumers spending a lot of money in the month of October. They didn't spend money on automobiles. Sales there off almost 4% after the heavy incentives of the summer. But the non-auto retail sales up by almost a full percentage point, following a 1.4% rise in September, 1.2% in August. So American consumers spending lots of money, and there's a funny heroic narrative of all that that sometimes you hear in the business media. There was someone on CNBC talking about the retail sales report the other day saying, got to admire the American consumer, you know. When they have money, they spend it. When they don't have money, they still spend it. Somehow that doesn't seem like a sustainable model in any sense, economic, ecological, cultural, whatever, but it is the American way. And then finally, the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index showing a gain in the first week of November after a couple of weeks of decline. So that is portending, it looks like, a stable, modestly growing U.S. economy in the coming months. And then finally, it was reported earlier this week that the Bloomberg campaign did extensive polling and found out that race no longer has the pull that it does in New York City politics. We don't really have exit polls to prove that, but it does for the precinct patterns. It looks like that a lot of black voters cast their ballot for Bloomberg, a Republican, and Ferrer did not get an overwhelming percentage of the Latino vote. If true, this could be of considerable significance. Remember that Kevin Phillips, the Republican political consultant, said he cut his teeth in New York politics by learning who hates whom. And he used that knowledge to devise Richard Nixon's Southern strategy in the late 1960s, whereby Nixon pulled away the white Southern voters based on coded and not-so-coded racial appeals. If that environment is changing in New York City, then perhaps this is of broader interest, well, to everyone, people who live here, but people who live elsewhere in the United States. Bears closer examination in the coming weeks and months. Not conclusive, but an interesting prospect. Let's take a little musical break, and I'll be back to introduce Bethany Morton. And that little excerpt from George Jones' song, High-Tech Redneck, a perfect setup for this interview about Walmart, which precisely embodies that contradiction. This is an interview I recorded yesterday with Bethany Morton, who is a graduate student in history at Yale, who has been studying Walmart's roots in the Ozarks of northwestern Arkansas. She's got an essay in this excellent new collection, Walmart, The Face of 21st Century Capitalism, edited by Nelson Lichtenstein, and just published by the New Press. Let's listen to Bethany Morton. I think a lot of people are kind of amazed. Walmart looks like a hick company in a lot of ways. It comes from a region of the United States that people associate, or at least urban people associate with backwardness, and yet it's incredibly advanced in many ways. It's revolutionized retailing. It's logistics sophistication is extraordinary. How do we mix this, the redneck and the high tech?
Well, I think you've hit on really one of their most extraordinary accomplishments, which is simply to make a virtue out of the necessity of being looked down upon in a lot of the country. The company is perfectly aware that people have this impression of the Ozarks and of Walmart. And have used it, I think, very intelligently against their opponents by being willing to be underestimated. It really doesn't matter if everyone's laughing at you as long as you wind up on top. And I think they had a very farsighted, intelligent approach to their critics. And they are probably having the last laugh at the moment, although the story's not all over.
Yeah. A lot of what they do requires immense amounts of organizational and technical talent. Was that all homegrown? It's a company that seems suspicious of fancy degrees and fancy education, yet their accomplishment is the highest level in a lot of ways. How does that happen?
A lot of the original technical expertise came from the World War II generation, which is true of a lot of developments in this part of the country coming out of the 40s and 50s is I was always struck by how many of the executives had served in the military. So that's one sort of underappreciated part of it, that you have to remember the revolutionary impact of having mass enrollment in the military in World War II created a generation of people from all over the country with a real appreciation for mass organizational tactics and very forward-looking people who are comfortable with technology. There was also a boom, of course, in public funding of education, in loans. This part of the country, as the rest of the country, saw an explosion in sort of white-collar level education at that time. So there was a great deal of recruitment of people who were comfortable with technology. What really is extraordinary about it is that the other industry giant at the point, Kmart, the one that Walmart was really always trying to catch up to, based in Detroit, you know, ground zero of the sort of industrial epoch in this country, was way behind Walmart technologically. And Sam Walton himself was not a huge fan of high tech, but he was the kind of person who was willing to listen to a strong argument in its favor. He mostly brought in people, mostly regional, not from the Northeast. People from the Northeast, people with elaborate blue-chip degrees, were not interested in working for this company. So he would bring in folks from that area who were willing to learn, willing to try something new, and meanwhile, Kmart kind of let its technological infrastructure fall way behind and wound up paying a big price for it in the 80s.
Walmart's home in the Ozarks is an important part of its the source of its original labor base. And you've got much interesting material in your essay about the yeoman farmer and the contribution of that development of Walmart. So could you talk a bit about that?
Sure. I mean, it's no news, I'm sure, to your listeners what a place the sort of independent Jeffersonian farmer holds in the American pantheon of heroes. And what's interesting about the Ozarks is that actually it's one of the very few places in the country after the very early colonial period where you really did have small farming, not deeply enmeshed in producing monocrops for markets like cotton or wheat, soybeans. They weren't doing that. They were having the real sort of, as close as you're going to get to the real yeoman mix of livestock raising, some corn, some vegetables, hunting, and so on, largely because it was lousy land and nobody could get in there in the mountains and put in a cotton crop that was particularly profitable. So you had a group of people who really did more than most have a stake in that yeoman mythos. And what that produced from Walmart's point of view was a lot of people who were looking for a way to stay where they're from, stay on the farm, stay in the Ozarks, but have a cash income that supplements farming. Almost no one can make a full-time living at any point in the 20th century off of a farm like that. So this is, of course, nothing new. If you want to start a low-wage, what people would call unskilled work, I would disagree very strongly with that characterization. But if you want to start an industry based on that kind of labor, it's very helpful to do it in a place where people can grow some of their food, have other options for producing cash income, have something to fall back on, have family support. That was very evident for a lot of people, that part of what enabled them to work in that kind of setting was that it was part of a very elaborate patchwork of family economic strategies.
It must have been kind of difficult to reconcile that yeoman farmer self-image with working as a clerk in a store. How'd that work out?
Well, that's what's so interesting about this particular echelon of work, is that if you look back, the role of being a clerk in a store certainly never enjoyed the same prestige as being an independent farmer. There was some overlap in the sense that if you're an individual proprietor of a store, you are your own master. This was the idea. And obviously that would be on a collision course with a company like Walmart that's so enormous and that has management folks who are not, in fact, stable in one place running a particular store for their whole lives and sort of living up to at least that ideal of self-mastery. They're on a salary. They do not, in fact, own the store. So what you see this historically, see how this works out with this company in this area, is that the what it looks to me like is that the psychological wage of mastery, which in part was a gender-based prestige, you are a master in part simply by being a man in a family, that was the pattern that worked for these stores. The very early Walmarts did, in fact, have systems of ownership by the many of the managers. So there was a transition period where the men running the stores were also, to some degree, their actual owners. All of that had to be consolidated into a giant corporation when the company went public in the early 70s. But by then, the pattern was, I think, pretty much in place, that being a manager at least preserved the psychological wage, the prestige of being a man running what looks like a family business. Usually just one mature adult male in charge of a store, a couple of younger sort of apprentice-type men working for him as assistants. they're going to move up to have their own stores, which is the yeoman pattern all over again, the idea that you work up to your own land, drove a great deal of settlement in this country. And then you have dependents, which is to say women, very young people, significantly older, retired people, the kinds of people whose work was valued on an independent farm, but not in a factory, not in many of the office settings that were produced by 20th century, other 20th century economic formations. So what I think is so brilliant about the way a Walmart works is that they found a way to appreciate and make very clear that they appreciated the labor of people who were not, in fact, crucial to, say, a Detroit auto factory, right? If you're a 65-year-old woman who's raised five kids and helped run a farm, which is always a joint occupation, and you're working in a Walmart, you're at least quite clear that your labor is valued, that people depend on you. I've met ladies in their 90s working in Walmarts who cannot drive anymore but walk to a Walmart to work because they know people are depending on them, their customers are depending on them. Rather than looking at this and saying, what's wrong with these people that they themselves don't value their work more and demand higher wages, what I thought was so interesting about it was that they feel deeply valued. And compared to many, or many of them do, I don't want to speak for everyone that works there. Obviously, I'm talking about many long-term stable employees that I interviewed. But they felt that, and I think you could make a case, that in comparison to many other workplaces, the one we're in, for example, there aren't a lot of spaces for a 65-year-old lady or a 17-year-old girl. The skills that those kinds of people brought to a Walmart made the company extraordinarily successful. Social skills, skills that were not valued in other parts of the economy, women's work to a large extent, the ability to deal with people, the ability to make people feel welcome and valued and to help people. People went to extraordinary lengths. You see over and over again in these early Walmarts, there will be thank you letters from customers saying, I couldn't believe what so-and-so did for me, came out and put together the swing set, tracked down the right color of thread for me, this kind of thing. I think it's really would be tragic to underestimate what that means in people's working lives.
But also the company, has been very patriarchal. Women are treated often quite badly by their male bosses. So how does that fit?
We're clearly talking to two very different groups of people. And I don't mean to suggest by reporting back the understandings and the experiences of the people I spoke to that that casts any doubt on things that other women have said. I think what we're looking at largely is a historical shift, that most of the people I talked to, because I was coming at the company from a historical point of view, were long-term employees in its home territory. These are the people for whom this would have been the best deal it ever was to anyone. First of all, they're self-selected in the sense that they all worked there a long time. If you didn't like it, presumably you wouldn't be looking to stick around for 20 years. Secondly, there's a generational difference from their point of view. The options that they had available to them are quite different from what a lot of people at least imagine their various opportunities to be today. But finally, they came out of a time and place that was in which Walmart represented a huge step up for the Ozarks. People said things like, can you imagine me having any kind of meaningful work here if it hadn't been for this company? I would have had to go to California. This was a very common experience for people in the Ozarks. Go to California and pump gas. Go to California and pick strawberry crops. You know, this is what people did.
Route 66 goes right through Walmart.
You got it. Route 66. You know, there's a reason that there's so much written about it. It can be a very wrenching experience, right, to be a permanent migrant. And what a company like Walmart represented to the folks that I was most interested in was stability and opportunities without having to leave home. And those opportunities may not look particularly glamorous from the outside, but the people I talked to were very insistent that I be faithful to their experience of it. That's not to say, and many of them would say this, that other experiences in other places and at other times weren't equally valid. And, of course, who we never heard from were folks who started in the Ozarks with the company and ultimately left.
I'm speaking with the historian Bethany Morton, who is the author of It Came from Bentonville, The Agrarian Origins of Walmart Culture, an essay in the excellent collection Walmart, The Face of 21st Century Capitalism, edited by Nelson Lichtenstein, just out from the New Press. It's a great historical irony that Walmart's roots are in a part of the country that was once a hotbed of a movement that is largely forgotten except by connoisseurs, the anti-chain store movement of the early 20th century. Tell us about that and what happened.
The anti-chain store movement, I hope other people find it interesting. I thought it was fascinating. This was, in some ways, sort of a last gasp of the populist movement at the turn of the century, or you could say a renaissance of it. The populists, of course, were defeated symbolically, you could say, in 1896, but then you see some of the populist platform, which would be greater government involvement, in protecting workers, protecting farmers, regulating railroads, transportation, communications, and so forth, this kind of thing. You see some of this reanimated in the 30s for the very good reason that the solutions put forth by corporations and industry at large had failed rather dramatically. And the anti-chain store movement was a part of that, but very specifically it was based in the area of the country that Walmart came out of. And that's what I found so fascinating, was that the very people who were making headlines in The Nation for protesting against chain stores.
And by The Nation, you mean the magazine, not the country.
Nation. Well, both, actually, but most interestingly symbolized by the magazine, The Nation. They were the, according to observers at the time, this was a ground zero, a hotbed of anti-monopolism, but very specifically about chain stores, that they wanted to see stores kept. Maybe you could have two or three, but certainly no more than 9 or 10 owned by the same person. And then to have 2-3 generations later, these people be the core constituency, as it were, of the world's largest retailer, and their former opponents be the people who are arguing against a giant chain store was just too rich of a historical irony to ignore.
So what happened?
Well, a couple of things happened. Probably the biggest defeat for the anti-chain store movement was simply that it proved unworkable. They actually won national legislation and a lot of state legislation, but also national legislation that limited ownership by chain stores. The problem was that once you got into a war economy and there was sort of a widespread national experiment with large corporate ownership, it became harder and harder to enforce this. And part of that was because they went at it at that stage through rules on pricing. The idea was to keep a chain store from offering discounts that smaller stores couldn't offer. And so what that winds up doing is pitting consumers against independent stores at a certain point.
I believe you point to the irony of farmers supporting higher prices for farm goods, but being really annoyed when the railroads charge them too much, right?
Right, exactly. And that was an interesting story in the anti-chain store movement, that the farmers were sort of on the fence there for a long time. They their political loyalties were with small ownership for exactly the sort of yeoman reasons that we talked about. But chain stores were able to show, chain grocery stores in this case, were able to show farmers in the Depression that their superior access to mass marketing, the chain store's superior access to advertising and mass marketing, would allow the farmers to unload bumper crops, that the chain store could be the friend of the farmer. And at that point, you really, when the anti-chain forces lost many farmers that way, and then they lost labor unions as their allies. Labor unions were on the side of giant chain stores. Then it was just a matter of time. And with the changes in the economy that were brought about by the war, you have people redefining themselves ultimately as consumers and seeing the small owners as often their opponents.
Yeah, it's funny. Just looking at the Greenwald movie, it opens with a small hardware store owner who is put out of business by Walmart ultimately. But the only vocabulary he has for criticizing him is subsidy by government and cheating of some sort. But there are tremendous economies of scale to an organization like Walmart that it's extremely difficult for a small store to match, right?
Exactly. And this was, you see this in the sort of folklore around chain stores in the 20s and 30s, that farmers and rural folks in general were often very suspicious. There weren't that many enormous entities around, right, at the time to compare it to. And people would be suspicious that the chain stores were able to offer such low prices, because you sort of have to have an experience of economies of scale to really get how that works. So instead, there was a lot of talk about shady practices and Shylocks, which I'm sure you can hear the sort of resonances there. But the idea was that a chain store couldn't, in fact, just be economically more capable of these economies of scale. It had to be that there was something very sinister about it.
To look at the degree of central planning in Bentonville, it almost seems like the realization of the fantasies of the Soviet planners. If only they had those computers. Well, what about the role of Chairman Sam in the imagination of it all? He's a kind of a larger-than-life figure, but almost 15 years after his death.
I know, really extraordinary. I don't think I met anyone in the Ozarks, regardless of their political position, who had anything truly unflattering to say about Sam Walton. He which is not to say that there weren't critiques available. It's to say that he did an extraordinary job of lining up his virtues with what exactly it is people value in that particular area. What Sam Walton had going on there, very intelligently, was he was known for being very ethical, and ethical means very strictly honest in terms of money. He was not greedy, and this was a big one for people, which, and what that means when you push people on that, what do you mean he's not greedy? He's the richest man in the country. What people say is, oh, but he's not a consumer, is really what they're saying. He didn't go out and spend the money on conspicuous consumption. And this in itself, for a lot of people, makes all his money-making activity quite praiseworthy, because he's clearly not doing it for pleasure. He's doing it out of a love of work. And out of, people would say things like, we're just grateful that he did this for us, that he created this company for us. It's not a role a whole lot of people could have pulled off. And in a part of the country coming out of an anti-chain movement and coming out of populism and anti-monopolism, it really needed someone to be the face of a giant company. You weren't going to have IBM coming out of the Ozarks. They get what's wrong with large impersonal bureaucratic organizations. They just don't experience this as one.
Finally, it looks like Walmart has pretty much saturated its home market. By that, I mean rural America, not just the Ozarks. And it needs to move into metropolitan areas to keep growing. It's getting a lot of criticism on Wall Street for not delivering the results anymore. Some people starting to think that its best days are behind it. Do you think they can make this transition, or is this company so deeply rooted in that Ozark culture that it's going to be nearly impossible to break into L.A. or New York?
You know, as a historian, you're always cautioned against making any sort of prediction. But I will say, yes, I think the company is deeply rooted in its culture, and I do think there's a finite number of people for whom that resonates. However, it may not be the case that it needs to resonate anymore. At a certain point, it may not be necessary if, in fact, you've reached a level of market dominance. I'm really not the person to opine on that. However, what I do think is very clear is that it's an extraordinarily resourceful company. These are not stupid people, no matter how much other folks don't like their accents. And they have done an amazing job, I think, of repositioning themselves as the friend of the most hard-up sector of urban America. I think the jury is definitively still out on how well that's going to go over, and there are very obvious failures on that front as well. But what's really interesting is that it has succeeded at all. And I would watch that aspect probably as one of the most interesting flashpoints here as they make this leap into urban markets. Because obviously the clash of cultures has had an enormous impact. But they have responded in very creative ways. And I think it would be wrong to assume that because country music and yellow ribbons around everything don't resonate for the Miracle Mile, that therefore Walmart can never make it in urban America. I think it's going to be a lot more complicated than that, and it's very interesting to watch these clashes play themselves out.
And that was the voice of Bethany Morton, who is a graduate student in history at Yale, who's been researching the Ozark origins of Walmart, and has a essay. It came from Bentonville in the new collection, Walmart, the Face of 21st Century Capitalism, edited by Nelson Lichtenstein, and just out from the New Press. And I will be back after this station break.
Hi, this is Danny Glover. You're tuned in to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
And this is WBAI, also on the web at WBAI.org. And my name is Doug Henwood, and the show is Behind the News. And just a comment on that previous segment before we move on. Bethany Morton was talking about the change in the Nation magazine's attitude towards Walmart, and I have been handicapped over the last couple of years in my coverage of Walmart because my wife, Liza Featherstone, wrote a book on sex discrimination at Walmart and also writes most of the Nation's coverage of Walmart. But I think the point she makes, that Bethany Morton makes, is kind of interesting. I can interview my wife is the point of that, so that would be that's why my coverage of this very important corporation has been somewhat hindered because I would very much like to, but it would look like self-dealing. But in any case, the point that Bethany Morton was making about the shift in the Nation and actually the shift in a lot of unions' positions towards chain stores and Walmart is very interesting. The unions in the early 20th century were very pro-chain. They thought that the chains brought efficiencies and lower prices and would be easier to organize than a lot of small stores. And we can see today that as hard a nut as Walmart is to crack, the bodegas and greengrocers around New York City are not the best employers by any means. They often pay their employees below minimum wage and don't offer any benefits at all. But they are even harder than Walmart to organize, I would say. So I think a lot of our traditional, a lot of people on the left have a nostalgia for small business and small retail stores, but there are real economies of scale in an operation like Walmart and greater possibilities for a unionization than in smaller entities, greater possibilities for regulating their environmental practices and many other things as well. So need to a little bit, I think, of fresh thinking about scale and scope and things like that. And now, joining the studio by Bruce Lawrence, who is the professor of religion at Duke and also a editor of a new volume just published by Verso, Messages to the World, The Statements of Osama Bin Laden. And I just an hour or so before coming down here, I got an email press release from a publicity firm. When you do a talk show and get listed in directories, you get more emails from publicists than you could ever possibly imagine. But this one is from a right-wing PR firm that says, "Dear producers, in the newly published book, Messages to the World, Bin Laden offers some advice to the United States on issues as diverse as climate change and the proper role of women. To columnist JunkScience.com editor environmental scholar Steve Malloy, it makes sense for America's number one enemy to advocate job-killing, economy-crushing environmental restrictions like Kyoto. Malloy believes that by endorsing the Kyoto Protocol, we see that Bin Laden and environmental extremists like Robert Kennedy Jr. have the same goal, the destruction of the Western economy. To schedule an interview with Steve Malloy, please call us at..." Well, I'll leave the phone number out of this, but that is a very interesting interpretation of the politics of Osama bin Laden. Welcome to WBAI, Bruce Lawrence.
Thanks, Doug. Good to be here.
I do want to talk about the politics of bin Laden in a moment, but first I do want to ask you, what is it like to spend many months in intimate intellectual contact with the man who is among the most demonized in the world?
Well, you learn that the demonization of him is only one half. The other part is the effort to make him into a hero, which happens the flip side of making him a demon. And while I don't like the guy, wouldn't want to spend time at a coffee shop, or on a bus with him, what's really fascinating is how he projects himself in the media. And I didn't know it before I went into, as you said, the deep read, the long study, the hanging out with OBL, that he is so clever with words. He's so clever with words. He actually is sarcastic, and he's also lyrical, and he's even at times humorous, but he's on message all the time, and the message is simple. He thinks religion is all that counts. Muslims are the ones that are beleaguered. Jews and Christians are the one beleaguering or capturing or killing, oppressing them. And it's all out war to the end. It's a simple message, but he tells it in 1,000 different ways.
Yeah, I was kind of amazed to see that the professional Arab basher Bernard Lewis had kind words for bin Laden's prose style.
Yeah, well, actually, I know Bernard Lewis, and I've seen Bernard Lewis in action, and he has an absolutely acerbic pen. But Bernard Lewis is at heart, his first book, after all, is History of the Arabs. He really knows Arabic, and he knows when someone's a professional. And I, too, when I first heard the guy, heard tapes of it, I said, you know, it's really hard to imagine looking at this guy that he is the arch killer and the global terrorist that he is, because he speaks in a mild-mannered way. He dresses well. He's always referring to God. He has a constant language of deferral, saying, I'm not doing this. It's God doing it through me. And he really knows his sources, the Quran, the Hadith, and so he misquotes them. I say that in the book. Several things where he just slices into the wrong take, or at least a partial take, of some passages from both the Quran and traditions of the Prophet Muhammad. But he does it with such a fluency that unless you know what he knows, you're not going to be able to stop him.
Yeah, we were talking a little earlier before we came on here that there's something kind of soft and almost effeminate about his manner, which is also kind of surprising for a man who is supposed to be the architect of great violence.
Yeah, well, Michael Shorter, who said openly in Imperial Hubris, I had a chance to kill the guy, and if President Clinton had given the orders, those missiles would have taken out him and a party of about 12 to 14 Arab rulers in eastern Afghanistan. The only problem is that some of those Arab rulers, it turns out, were really friends of the United States, and it would have caused quite a furor. But Shorter, who not only didn't love the guy, but was ready to kill him, and would have had he gotten the orders, said, you know, after having spent all this time looking at him and listening to him and tracking him and trying to kill him, I have to say he's one hell of an articulate enemy.
Let me impersonate for a moment a right-wing Yahoo who would say, why publish this guy? Isn't this like publishing the recipe for weaponizing anthrax on the web?
Sure.
So are we just encouraging the worst elements in humanity by doing this?
My jarhead friends, and I've got them, Marine Corps officers who've had to serve in Iraq, and they've said to me, you know, we're really glad you published this because you gave us bin Laden, but you also gave us commentary. Now, if I just did a raw and ready bin Laden in his own words, without my words, framing it, I think they'd have some justification for skewering me and saying, hey, you know, you're serving the enemy and not us. But actually, I hope that people can read this book and read the fine print, which in this case are the head notes, the end notes, the introduction, where I say, look, the guy is a master with words, as well as obviously with weapons of war. And you have to understand him if you're going to ever kind of counter him and eventually defeat him. Somebody said to me, you know, you're really just like one of those Chinese sages who said, keep your friends close, but keep your enemies closer. And I said, yes, but in this case, I'd rather just be close to his words and not to his actual weapons.
How did he get from being a rich kid in Saudi Arabia to being a cave-dwelling nemesis? What was the biographical course of bin Laden?
You know, if I could tell you that, I should be in Washington instead of New York. I ought to be down in the Pentagon instead of on Wall Street. But the truth is, we don't know. I mean, lots of speculation. My own simple answer is that he was always the outsider. First of all, he comes from Yemen, not Saudi Arabia. Some people say it's no big deal. They're next-door neighbors. But, you know, they're very, very different. They're even more different than, if you can imagine that, I don't want to be too outrageous, but they're even more different than the Knicks and the Nets, you know, if you can wrap their mind around the difference between the Knicks and the Nets. They're neighbors, but no one would ever say that they're best of friends. Well, he is a Yemeni, and they're not friends of the Saudis, so he always is a slight outsider. He wasn't a great student. In fact, he had less than mediocre grades. Didn't flunk, but he didn't have flying colors. Then he spent some time in Egypt, and I think it was a time in Egypt that was an incubator, and then it was his time in Afghanistan where he proved his mettle that he could actually fight instead of just talking about fighting. And then he got a chance to be in the Sudan, and that was a huge bump for him because all the people who fought with him in Afghanistan, all the Afghan Arabs, came back, huddled down, got their strategies worked out, and then when he went back to Afghanistan around 96, he was ready.
That's the voice of Bruce Lawrence, who is the editor of Messages to the World, the statements of Osama bin Laden, just out from Verso. Well, some people think of him as an anti-imperialist. Is that a correct label to apply to him, or is he operating in a different realm from earthly considerations like that?
Both. He is an anti-imperialist, but he wraps his venomous language, because you can't say that it's sugar-coated. It's actually extracts that he takes from the Quran, but puts them in the context of the modern-day warfare that he says has gone on from Palestine to Chechnya to Somalia and obviously Iraq and Afghanistan. Every place where there's been not just American and British but also Russian interests played out against Muslims, he says it shows that these other people really hate Muslims and really have one goal, to kill Muslims. So how does he pull this off, this anti-imperialist rhetoric? He wraps it in language that echoes the Quran. Sometimes it's a direct quote. As I said at one point, what really shocked me the most in reading him, as you said, hanging out with him for 6 months, was I started to hear some of the poetry, and I thought, gee, he knows some poets I've never read. And then at one point we discovered he's the poet. That bin Laden himself writes poetry. Wow. Bingo. And then we went back and started to read some of the things. Every point where he wants to accent his anti-imperialism, he throws in a poem. And you may say, well, gee, who really care? Arabs care. I would say there's not an equivalent in English, but I don't know if you remember Pablo Neruda from Mexico, but the kind of language that Pablo Neruda used that was very powerful, evoking kind of the sentiments of a lost world, that sort of romanticization of the past, lyrically put together, is what bin Laden projects in Arabic poetry. He's a good poet. He's not a great poet, but he's a good one.
What is his goal? Is it earthly transformation? Is it the achievement of heaven through martyrdom? Does he have a vision of converting the whole world to Islam? What is the ultimate goal of bin Laden and Al-Qaeda?
Well, you know, I think his first goal is that he's remembered. And not only remembered well, but that he becomes the hero of this constant struggle, which actually doesn't have a time frame. Oh, well, he says it began back with the Crusades, began back in the 13th century. He says it has started really anew in the 20th century with the Sykes-Picot Treaty in 1918. But then he rolls it forward and he says, you know what? It won't end until all Americans and all foreigners withdraw from Muslim lands. You know when that'll happen? Never. Not in our lifetime.
Well, he certainly was aided in his rise to prominence and power by the CIA, their war against Afghanistan, and also the alliance with the Pakistani Secret Service, the ISI. So what role did that play in the development of his thinking? Was this just a relationship of convenience, or did he was there something deeper than that?
You know, the same way I quoted Sun Tzu, you know, keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer. He kept us very close, meaning the CIA, the ISI, which doesn't have the same material but has great human resources. He learned from them over a period of 8 to 9 years. And then when the Afghan war ended, the Soviets were expelled. First of all, he took credit for it. And then when we withdrew, he had open playing field. And so, yeah, sure, the CIA, the ISI, but I would also say the Saudi government. Don't for 1 minute think that he forgot his own roots. In fact, he wanted to go back to Saudi. His greatest disagreement with the Saudis was that they did not employ him and his Afghan fighters to evict Saddam Hussein from Kuwait in 1991. Had that happened, we might never have seen 2001.
And what about that relation with Saddam Hussein? Of course, some of the more feverish elements of the right think that they're best buddies, but of course that's not plausible. But what about that relationship?
They are not buddies, as ex-President Clinton is with the first President Bush. These people are not hanging out from different parties and finally get along in a copacetic worldview. They are such enemies that if you read bin Laden's letters and these statements that I put together from 1994 to 2004, Saddam Hussein comes up about two or three times, and it's always to say, this is the man whom we can't possibly trust. This is the man who's outside the pale. But by the way, the Iraqi people whom he has ill-served are our friends and our allies. He was saying this as far back as 94.
Saddam, after the first Gulf War, took a bit of a religious turn, but Osama was not persuaded by that. Huh?
Not a bit.
And now, what role has the American invasion of Iraq played in his thinking?
Huge. Three of the letters that we've got in here are statements that became later published as letters from Osama bin Laden to the Iraqi people, are precisely saying, listen, what we did in Afghanistan, meaning he takes credit, doesn't give the CIA or even the ISI a nod of the head, what we did, meaning the Mujahideen, the people who fought with him, the Arab Afghans, if you will, against the Soviets, what we did in Afghanistan in the 80s, you can do against the U.S. and the U.K. In the new century from Iraq. So, yes, Iraq gave him incredible new opportunities to actually try and employ what he calls the Afghan strategy in a new playing field. I don't think it's going to work. I frankly think that that's a failed comparison, and it's an unlikely outcome. But for him, and for obviously some
people, why it's not going to work?
Well, I don't think it's going to work because I don't think Afghanistan and Iraq are comparable. I think that there is going to be some sort of devolution of the war. I don't think that we can continue at the level we're doing and actually win militarily. But I also think that we can't lose in the sense, meaning the United States and the UK and the allies, we can't lose in the sense that there will be a society that will be wrapped around an Islamic extremist ideology of the kind Bin Laden wants, because he never spells it out. And because there isn't actually, beyond the fighting and the constant call for martyrdom, there's not what I would call, what anyone would call, a social, economic, political plan for redevelopment and for regenerating a new society after war is over. This doesn't exist.
Yeah, you mentioned that there's sometimes a parallel drawn between Al-Qaeda and the Red Brigades in Italy, but you don't buy that.
Well, no, but the only reason I don't buy it is because the Red Brigades didn't have the possibility of dispersion in the way in which global jihad goes from parts of Africa all the way to Southeast Asia and Indonesia. So what's really different is the scope of it. And also Bin Laden, unlike Tony Negri, does not need to be either in prison or held up as a hero. All he needs to have is the message go out. And as I said at one point in there, this translation makes available to us, meaning to people, Americans who don't read Arabic, what he said. But the audio tapes, the original Arabic audio tapes of Bin Laden, are still distributed all throughout the world. So he has a kind of, if you will, ideological resource, a kind of idea bank that most people, including the Red Brigades, never had.
You're an expert in Islamic theology. Well, how does he fit in? Is he
outsider.
A bit of a renegade?
Outsider. But let me just say, what's mainstream Christian theology? Is it Mormonism? Is it Catholicism? Is it Adventism? I mean, there's no kind of mainstream in most religious traditions. And Judaism, has great differences between conservative, Orthodox, and Reform. So if you're saying within the range of what most people expect, he's outside it. But he has some antecedents. He dwells on those antecedents when he's attacked, as he is and should be attacked, for killing innocents, meaning women and children, and it's definitely forbidden in the Quran and by traditions of the Prophet Muhammad. He comes back and says, oh, yes, but under certain circumstances it's allowed, and these are those circumstances.
What about some people sometimes say that although fundamentalism presents itself as a return to the old verities, in fact, it's a very modern phenomenon. Does that apply in this case?
I think I'm one of the people who said that. One of my earlier books, Defenders of God, The Fundamentalist Revolt Against the Modern Age, made the point that fundamentalists are pragmatically modern, but theologically medieval or anti-modern in their outlook. So this idea that modernity is sort of a one-stop and once you become modern, you give up religious beliefs, I think fundamentalism has proven that you can fly planes, you can use fax, you can use phone, you can obviously use airplanes to your own benefit as a terrorist, if you will, but you still have a worldview that is fundamentally not modern in the sense it doesn't accept pluralism, it doesn't accept multiple perceptions or applications of truth. It only sees one God, one scripture, one way forward.
Sometimes said that he and other fundamentalists are looking to restore the 14th century. What is that 14th century that they fantastically trying to restore?
Well, the 14th century is a pretty nasty place. First of all, it was the plague over here, meaning in Europe and England. The 14th century wouldn't be anything that people would want to revisit with glee. People may say the avian flu will take us back to the 14th century. I hope that's not true. But the 14th century, for Ibn Laden, what's glorious about it for him is that that's when a guy named Ibn Taymiyyah, who is one of his heroes, stood up to the Mongols. The Mongols had decimated the known world, not just the Muslim world, but also, of course, Europe and Russia in the 13th century. And Bin Laden is saying, you know what, if we can go back to the 14th century, in some way we can have a better shot at making the world a kind of Muslim community called Ummah. He used that word Ummah, U-M-M-A. But in fact, he's not a restorationist. I would say he's a nihilist. He's a nihilist who wants war, 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 because there are no limits to the war. If the only condition for stopping war is American and allied withdrawal from the Muslim world, it won't happen.
That's the voice of Bruce Lawrence, who is the editor of a collection of the statements of Osama bin Laden called Messages to the World, just out from Verso. And he's got there's a few pages in the book where he enumerates his problems with America. And it almost sounds like that Bush is, they hate us for our freedoms is a half-truth, in a sense. We got too many drugs and booze and AIDS and sex in the Oval Office, and the Americans didn't seem to care very much about it. He sounds like one of our fundamentalists in that way. Gambling, overconsumption, advertising sounds almost like Ralph Nader in that critique. Right. And, of course, then the Jews run everything in America. But what is this line, they hate us for our freedoms, how much truth is there to
that? You know, that one letter, by the way, is number 16, and if people are trying to proof text my text and say, where can I find what Doug just mentioned, and I didn't read it, it's number 16. Number 16, I say in my introduction to it, you know what, I'm not 100% sure this is OBL. The style of that thing, the instances you just mentioned, the kind of saying, you know, America's debauched, it's got, you know, it's got too much sex, it's got too much drugs, it's got too much of a licentious culture. All this sounds as if you're right, that they hate us for our freedom. But he doesn't do that anywhere else. It's like this one letter. And so we hesitated about including it. The only reason we included it, and I say it in the introduction there, is because Islamist websites put it up and they say, hey, this is also Osama bin Laden. But the style of it, those particular instances you gave, it's not the kind of, if you will, it's not the sort of ratcheting up of the polemical rhetoric that you find him. He's a polemicist, but he likes big themes, not little details.
Now, if I were Christopher Hitchens, I would say there's a lot of writing in this book about the fate of Palestinians. And
yeah.
If I were Christopher Hitchens, I would say that's pure opportunism, that he doesn't really care about what's going on with the Palestinians. Is that
half true? Only not true. Not all the way true, half true. The reason it's
what's
half true
and what's not?
Well, it's because he invokes the Palestinians from day one, or from year one, which is 1994 when this book of collected statements begins. So from 1994, when he excoriates, he really heaves some heavy language at the Saudis for not having honored the Palestinian cause and not having stood up to the United States, et cetera, et cetera. He comes back to the Palestinians, but the thing I think that really tripped him off is that the Saudis invited the Americans in and didn't allow him to evict Saddam Hussein, and then that they also, he claims, provided the Israeli Air Force with the weaponry they needed to bomb Beirut in 82. That's what he said last year in December 2004 was the tripwire. But whether it's the Saudis or the Lebanese, I think those are much more his causes than the Palestinians. It's not that he doesn't at some level say Palestinians matter, but I don't think it's the heart of his grievances.
Just after September 11th, my mother-in-law said, can we find out who these people are and just give them what they want? And certainly a lot of the critique in these pages of our America's abuse of Arabs, of our attitude towards Islam, of our support for Israel and its treatment of the Palestinians. You know, there's a lot of truth to this, certainly. Would that be enough to defuse the bin Laden threat?
No, I'm not in the camp of those who say we should sit down and talk with, obviously not bin Laden, but with somebody who represents al-Qaeda interests. And the reason I say is because what's now on the table after Afghanistan and after Iraq, the ongoing war on terror, is not simply withdrawal of American military force. It's also withdrawal of American economic interests. And it also means Israel withdrawing not just from the West Bank, but from all of Palestine. It would be what the current Iranian president called for, that Israel ceases to exist. That's impossible, untenable. A utopian goal for some American foreign policy thinkers, there will always be an Israel at the core of our Middle East policy. So as long as Israel exists, I'll be so blunt as to say, as long as Israel exists, we will not satisfy al-Qaeda. And how can we go anywhere towards that if Israel is part of our objectives, which it should be?
So what then should be the approach of the U.S. government towards bin Laden and his people?
More earthquake aid to Pakistan. I've said from day one, it's amazing that this just drops off the screens. Best program I've seen on anything is Bob Simon, not from the U.S. government, from 60 Minutes, whom I don't often praise, but Bob Simon, 60 Minutes, they hit it. 13 American firefighters from guess where, New York City.
I saw that. It was a very good,
it was
good
great
segment. Yeah.
Hey, come on, you read that, you say, hey, they care about some Muslims. Not about Muslims, but about people who are in need. And that's the key thing. You don't answer them by saying, oh, we're Jews, Christians, pagans, secularists, whatever, and we still care about Muslims. No, these are people in need. They happen to be extraordinarily at risk. And we have the possibility of helping them, and 13 New York City firefighters did what the U.S. government hasn't done.
All right, we have to bring it to a close there. Thank you for joining us. Bruce Lawrence, who is the editor of Messages to the World, the Statements of Osama bin Laden, just out from Verso. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I think I'm away next week for Thanksgiving, but I'll be back after that. And let's go out with this from Tracy and the Plastics, which is actually a single performance artist named Wynn Greenwood, who then impersonates on video her bandmates, Cola and Nikki and Cola. But it's Tracy and the Plastics.